Fortnight in Film is a podcast where every week you get the chance to listen in on a group of film lovers chatting about the great, or not so great, movies that we've been watching over the past fortnight. Hello and welcome to episode 40 of A Fortnight in Film. I'm your host, Jason.
And I'm your co-host, George.
And I'm the other co-host, Jacob.
Thanks for tuning in. This is our first group episode of the year, first group episode in a very long time. Our last group episode was in February 2022.
February. Oh my, over a year ago.
Literally, long over a year ago.
Really?
Wait,
no, when did we start the podcast?
September 2021.
Okay.
So we haven't had a group episode in a damn long time, which was time zone's fault, as opposed to our fault.
And also Christian having a baby and picking up various hobbies probably plays into it as well. But
anyway, we're all here now.
Yeah, for the first time.
The way it's going to work is because we are on two time zones now instead of three. We're going to do more regular group episodes. We're going to do them once a month, and we're going to pick a theme each episode. So it's basically like a normal episode. We just pick three films and chat about them, but they're all aligned to a specific theme, which we have done before. Especially you and I, George, it's like, seems like every second episode we do is like inadvertently a themed episode. But this is a deliberately themed episode. So the theme for this episode is stop motion, which I really had no experience with before. I'm sure I had watched a stop motion film before, but...
Well, you're not a big...
No, I know.
You're
not
a big animation guy in general. I mean, neither am I. I watch animation, but I'm not a huge animation guy.
I don't know. I feel like animation, when I think of animation, I associate it with, kids.
So close-minded, Jason.
Open up.
Works of art sometimes, you know.
Well, and the ones we watched, especially probably my pick, is adult oriented.
I mean, I would argue that George's pick is sort of adult oriented too.
It's pretty much for adults. Also, with some animated films like Shrek or like other things like that, they often include like jokes and like references that adults can pick up on. So you can still enjoy them as an adult as well, like not just as a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, that's like what people say about something like The Simpsons is you rewatch it as an adult and you pick up on all the stuff you missed as a kid.
If you watch an animation
aimed at like 5 or 6 year olds or like super young, then fine. But
I don't think Bluey or Peppa Pig has any like hidden meanings behind it.
I was gonna say Bluey really, you know, has a bit of a cult following among a lot of parents and sort of even people that don't have children.
It's like international It's obviously an Australian show, but it's
just
like
cute.
Gone global.
Wait, I haven't heard of it actually.
Haven't you?
Surprising. So
it's just like a show about a dog.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's about as much as I know.
You're really selling it here. It's a show about a dog.
Why are we even listening to Jason? He doesn't watch cartoons. Exactly. Oh my god!
Come on, who is this guy?
Talking of George's pick, should we kick it off with George's pick?
We shall.
Yes.
So this is Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio from last year. I think it won the best animated film at the Oscars.
Yes, it did.
It did.
Yeah.
Shall I dive into a story? I'll dive into the plot.
And interestingly, note that we're not talking about the other Pinocchio that came out last year, which is, it's very confusing. There were two Pinocchios that came out in the same year. So there was a Pinocchio, which was like Tom Hanks, and it was like this weird live action / CGI weird mashup thing.
Yeah, it was a live action remake of the 1940.
And it got destroyed by the critics.
Yeah. I'm not surprised. It looked awful.
Whereas this is the much more highly acclaimed Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which is pure animation, stop motion, and is, even having not seen the other one, I would guess is much better.
Oh no, I haven't seen it, but it's clearly
Pinocchio was originally, was it the Grimm brothers or Hans Christian Andersen?
It was
Carlo
Carlo
Collodi.
Right, okay.
Carlo Collodi. Yeah. Yes. In 1880s. Yes, okay. So some people I think just think of it as like the Disney film from the 40s. It's a book before I think there was like a silent film in the 20s and some other adaptations.
Yeah, there's been so many adaptations of it.
But yeah. Okay. Well, shall I get... Sorry if you zone out during the story, but I'll just read it. So we start in Italy during World War One with a carpenter called Geppetto, who loses his son Carlo during a bombing, which inadvertently hits their town. So they're like in the church, and I think they're meant to bomb another town, but they sort of accidentally hit this one. So Carlo dies, and Geppetto basically honors his memory by planting a pine cone near his grave and spends the next sort of 20 years mourning his loss. Then a cricket turns up, which can speak, called Sebastian, and takes up residence in the tree that's like grown out of the cone. And then coincidentally, just as Sebastian has sort of set up shop in there, Geppetto turns up and cuts down the tree in like a fit of sort of drunken rage in order to make a new son out of the wood. So he does this, and then he passes out drunk, leaves the puppet not finished, and then a blue sort of wood, what is it?
Wood sprite. It reminded me of that creature in Princess Mononoke. That like forest thing. I was like, oh, it's sort of like that kind of.
That's a similar thing. Yeah. Really beautiful to look at. Like the blue. Like really, really nicely animated. But anyway. So the wood sprite basically brings it to life, christening him Pinocchio. The sprite meets Sebastian and promises to grant him a wish, which he intends to use in order to become famous in exchange for acting as Pinocchio's sort of guide. Right. Geppetto in the morning, in a quite a scary scene, he discovers that Pinocchio is alive and locks him in a closet while he goes to church. But Pinocchio sort of breaks out, follows him, and frightens the villagers at this church service. Pinocchio is treated suspiciously. There's this like evil local podesta who like is like the fascist sort of like controller of the town, who like visits Geppetto at his house and basically tells him to keep Pinocchio in line. And it's worth noting that Podesta has a son called Candlewick, who gets to know Pinocchio. Wait, is he called Candlewick in this film as well?
Okay. Yeah, that's his name.
So he gets to, the boy kind of gets to know Pinocchio during your visit as well. The next day, Geppetto sends Pinocchio to school, but he's intercepted by a former aristocrat turned showman called Count Volpe, and his performing monkey Spazzatura. Volpe convinces Pinocchio to join his circus and gets him to sign a contract with Pinocchio like signs it with like a smiley face. Don't know how legal that is, but anyway. So after Geppetto arrives to bring Pinocchio home, he and Volpe have a tug of war that results in Pinocchio being thrown to the road where he is hit by a car driven by the Podesta and his wife. Pinocchio is sent to the afterlife where he meets Death, who's the sister of the wood sprite. And she explains to Pinocchio that he is immortal and that he will return to the mortal realm once an hourglass has flowed, warning him that the time he spends in the afterlife will increase each time he returns. So Pinocchio returns to the mortal realm, decides to join Volpe's circus, basically to earn cash for Geppetto and to avoid being drafted into the army by the Podesta, who views him as this sort of immortal killing machine. Sebastian and Geppetto set off to search for Pinocchio, having to cross the sea where they are swallowed by a giant dogfish, is what it's apparently called. It's a whale in the original one, but it's a dogfish here. Then during one of his performances, Pinocchio sings a toilet humor sort of laden parody of a song to Benito Mussolini as revenge to Volpe's abuse, which is so funny for a Pinocchio film. He just sings a song about shit to Benito Mussolini, which is hilarious. But that sort of, he does that as sort of like revenge for Volpe's abuse and is shot and dies again. Then he is again revived, but is taken by the Podesta to like a sort of fascist training camp for small boys who train themselves to fight in the war. Pinocchio sort of properly befriends Candlewick, the son of Podesta, who is sort of scared of disappointing his father and being seen as weak. And then there's a whole scene where sort of on Pinocchio's advice, Candlewick stands up to his father, but the training camp gets bombed and the Podesta's killed. Pinocchio escapes, but is captured by Volpe, who wants revenge against Pinocchio for sort of the whole Mussolini thing. But Spazzatura, the monkey, intervenes, and they are all sent over the cliff with Volpe dying. Pinocchio rescues Spazzatura, but they are swallowed by the dogfish, where, of course, they reunite with Geppetto and Sebastian, who were swallowed earlier. Then Pinocchio... They think of a plan where Pinocchio has to tell some lies to make his nose grow so they can escape through the blowhole. So they like make a bridge, and then just as they escape, so then they're escaping and the dogfish sort of sneezes, which sends them all out. Then the dogfish basically tries to eat them again, but this forces Pinocchio to sacrifice himself by detonating a mine, which the dogfish has swallowed. And then upon meeting death again, he demands to be set back early so that he can save Geppetto from drowning, despite the fact that this will result in his sort of proper death. Then after rescuing Geppetto, Pinocchio dies, which prompts Sebastian to use his wish to make Pinocchio come back. So he basically gives up his wish to become famous in order for Pinocchio to live. So then, as Death told Pinocchio, he manages to outlive all of his loved ones as Geppetto, Sebastian, and Spazzatura all die over the course of time. And Pinocchio decides to travel off to sort of parts unknown for new adventures. And that's it. So yeah, a bit long-winded. Yeah, but that's the story. Who wants to go first?
you go first. It's your first group episode, Jacob. You go first.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
You liked it? Yeah. What was your rating of it on Letterboxd?
I can't remember. I can't remember when I rated it, but I'd probably give it a 3.5-4.
Yeah.
Stars.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
Okay. Good. Jason.
I mean, I'd give it 4 stars. I thought it was a great film. I didn't expect to like it as much as I did, because I probably was going into this bias of like, oh, it's Pinocchio, it's a kids' film. It was actually, I loved it. And I can't really, I can't explain why. It's just one of those films where, like, you love everything about it, but it just, you don't give it that full 5 stars, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, I can't give it that full 5 stars because it's not, like, this amazingly perfect film, but I'm like, I can't really find anything wrong with it. I thought, like, the animation was just, like, beautiful. Like, it just looked amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I think they did a really good job.
The thing is with stop motion as well, like, you can tell the effort that they put into it. Like, the hours. I didn't watch the behind the scenes, I want to. But, like, I can... hundreds of hours put into animating, like, the smallest,
The transitions between the scenes were, like, seamless.
It's crazy. Some of the scenes, there's... God, what scene it was, but they used a really large scale Pinocchio head for it, so they could like animate, I think it was close up of Sebastian J. Cricket, and the fact that there was like a massive Pinocchio, but there's also a really 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 small Pinocchio too for some scenes, you know, so they really went all out to try and capture those details.
Looked amazing. The colors, like, I love the colors. It was just such a vivid looking film. Like, it was just very like rich in the way it looked. I mean, the voice acting I thought was great. And like, that's the thing with like animated films, is it so much, that's the thing I always notice, is because you don't have actors or actresses, like, you're relying solely on their voice. And so it's like, and that's really what I'd say for all three of the films we're going to talk about today. Like, all the voice acting was great. which I think adds so much to it when you can't see the person, like you're watching an animation. Like there's only so much an animated thing can do.
It must be quite difficult as an actor because, like, obviously you're relying in live action, you're relying more on your sort of face,
your body, or your facial expressions.
You're relying on your face and your body, but with this, you just have to get all your emotion across just on voice. So when you watch actors like in the booth doing stuff like this, they're often like acting kind of as they would in a live action thing, which is interesting.
Like the songs, I thought the songs were like fun and catchy.
Oh, don't get me started on the songs.
I will say though, the first song caught me so off guard. I was like, I didn't know. I knew obviously the Disney one is a musical, but
I didn't know it was a musical.
No, I didn't know. So when Pinocchio started singing, I was like, what?
That's funny because that's the same thing I said about La La Land. I didn't know it was a musical. Yeah. And I was like, when it started, I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, it's a musical. Yeah. Like,
but then I settled into it and it was fine. I mean, the songs in the Disney version are more iconic and sort of well-crafted. Yes,
When You Wish Upon a Star, yeah.
Yeah, but they're still good. They're still good here.
Like, I just thought it was probably just, like, one of the most, like, of the films I saw that came out last year, and obviously I've only seen it now, but, like, of the films I saw released last year, it's probably like the most like heartwarming, charming film. Like, and it's probably one of the most like charming films I've seen in a while, like of anything. Like, it's just so, it just had that thing.
I think that's the beauty of sometimes the beauty of animation, especially stop motion of that craft. It is so warm, you know? I think they took that idea of the, as you mentioned, the pine cone, and that sort of is sort of sandwiched too. There's like a pine cone in the very beginning and they craft Pinocchio out of, you know, the wood and everything. And then there's a pine cone in the end, But something else that I heard anyway is they took that idea, that sort of woodiness, and they used that to try and craft everything else. If that makes sense, like to sort of get that vibe.
Well, like the sort of texture, like
The texture, the look, you know, it does have that sort of like oaky tumbra without any other word to use. You know what I mean?
What did you think, George? Is this your pick?
Well, I gave it 4 stars. I'm sort of in the same boat as you in terms of like the animation. Yeah, it was like gorgeous. Like I loved every frame.
Anyway. I loved it.
The bit gorgeous. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
chef's kiss. you know, the scenes where he like goes to the afterlife and with like death, like the sort of her, like they're really stunning. And I have a friend who loves the sort of like hand drawn classic Disney animation. And he loves the original like 1940 Pinocchio. So I watched that a while ago and I think I gave it 3 stars. So I do like it, and I don't like to compare these two because like the styles are different, but I like this one a bit more because it has like a much more complex, and it's much more complex and has a lot more like themes going for it. Like,
and it just feels, I just feel like it feels more real.
Yeah. Because like in the original one, the message is kind of like, just be a good boy, don't be naughty. And that's pretty much it. Like, which is fine, but it's lighthearted, very lighthearted. But this
He's
one,
not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy.
Is that, yeah. but this one, you have like the story set up, obviously, with Geppetto's son, Carlo, dying. It like it sort of introduces sort of emotional stakes sort of right away, and then the whole arc of Geppetto basically sort of he's sort of learning to move on from Carlo and accept Pinocchio as his own son in a different way than Carlo was, because like he's scared to love Pinocchio again because it means he'll potentially have to face losing a son again like he did with Carlo. So it's kind of like loving him means becoming sort of vulnerable to that pain again. So he kind of has to get over that. I like that sort of theme. So I actually found Geppetto's arc to be the most sort of satisfying in it. Even though Pinocchio's was good as well. I think Count Volpe was good as well. He was a good villain, as was the Podesta. I thought the fascism stuff was a little, like, it was good setting it in fascist Italy. I thought it lent it a quite sort of complex sort of aura. But it was a little bit on the nose sometimes with Mussolini. But you know, that could be excused. I guess.
It's like they just wanted to make fun of Mussolini.
Yeah, yeah, which is fine. Which is fine. Like, you know.
I like the line where he turns around to one of his, is it to one of his henchmen? And he goes, I like puppets. and he's just such a child.
Yeah. There's actually a good quote I found here. It says, I can't remember where I saw it, but it says, as in his earlier works, Del Toro explores the wounding effects of fascism on youth, here by setting the plot in interwar Italy. While he might be a puppet, Pinocchio is one of the few characters who exist of their own agency, gleefully rejecting the assumption of ideology or utility by instead singing a song about poop. So it's basically like, because he like awakens in like a society of people who behave like obedient puppets, but like by contrast, he is independent, irrepressible. He can't bring himself to abide by the rules of like authority figures. So it's sort of like attacking fascism, because like saying you should be like Pinocchio, basically, like go against authority when it's clearly.
I think maybe that's a really good point. So his nose doesn't really. Does it grow?
The only time it really grows is when they need it to at the end.
Yeah, pretty much. So there's that in there. But I think the fact that he is sort of his own person, you know, in that sort of fascist, maybe that's it. You know, we got to, because, you know, when Pinocchio is being bad and he's lying in the traditional story and his nose grows, it's almost like it's, what's the word? He's self-righteous, you know? So the self-righteous is the lying, if that makes sense. It's completely subverting the original story.
Yeah. Yeah, there's another... That does link in. There's another quote I found here which links into that. It says, Del Toro chose to move away from the book's apparent agenda, which seemed to seek to repress the spirits of children and to encourage blind obedience to parents and other authority figures. He instead saw the development of Pinocchio's autonomy as a virtue. The film is orientated around self-discovery and moral agency. So yeah, it is sort of that, like in the original, it's saying be a good boy, listen to your parents and authority. But this one, it's like, don't do that. Be your own sort of person and sort of strike out on your own grounds, I suppose.
It really shows how far we've come since like, say the 1930s, you know, be a good boy. And then Disney doesn't, these days they don't really change their formula too much, you know. They're all about that lighthearted sort of, you know.
Wokeism. Disney's woke.
Is that, yeah, woke.
Oh, here we go. Oops. I just knocked a whole heap of things off my shelf.
Calm down now. Sorry, I take it back.
Oh my God. Should you pick them up or is it okay?
No, it's fine. Okay, it's just Sora and Goofy. Okay. I knocked Goofy and Sora off the shelf. No. If you've ever played Kingdom Hearts. Yeah, this is totally Disney, valet.
Yeah, see, Disney heard we're talking about him, and they just jumped off the shelf.
I think so. That's creepy.
One more quote I found, which is quite good. It's it says, most previous renditions of this story feature the necessity of physical transmutation from wooden puppet to flesh and blood. Del Toro rejects this concept that Pinocchio must physically change in order to be loved by his father. The film asserts that the essence of humanity lies in the feelings of interiority and the expressions of exteriority. So basically, it doesn't matter that he's not a real boy. It's about what you are like inside, I guess. Like, Geppetto's journey is accepting and loving Pinocchio for who he is. Like, he doesn't need to be, like Carlo, a real boy. It's about what he's like as an individual. That's another sort of theme I found.
We're off to a good start. We all liked the first film.
Yeah, very good. Very nice. A little bit of analysis into that one.
Do you want to move on to your pick, Jacob?
Okay, so my pick was Coraline, which was directed by Henry Selick. And he actually did Nightmare Before Christmas
Thought that was Tim Burton for the longest time until I read that it was... this Henry Selick guy.
You see, I'm pretty sure Nightmare Before Christmas was written by Tim Burton, but, and I don't know if he was supposed to be directing it.
It says story by Tim Burton, produced by Tim Burton. But it's such a Tim Burton film. Like, it's so, it's such a film when you think of Tim Burton, you're like, what's the sort of thing he'd direct? Like,
but that's interesting because everybody always thinks, you know, Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, and they think that's almost like, you know, I suppose our generation, you know, it's probably like one of the first. James and the Giant Peach, I think, was an earlier than Nightmare Before Christmas. I can't remember.
But it was A Nightmare Before Christmas. That's sort of Tim Burton's creation, though. Or is it his like idea, or was it based on?
I think it was
else?
Just. I don't know if he got the story from anywhere else.
So it was Henry Selick's feature directorial debut, and it says it was produced and conceived by Tim Burton. So it's basically his idea, and then Henry Selick just directed it. And in fairness, it is known as Tim Burton's A Nightmare Before Christmas, which is very confusing.
Yeah. So for all intents and purposes, it is a Tim Burton film.
Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. So, yeah, Henry Selick also did James and the Giant Peach as well. I saw that way before Coraline. Somewhat recently, too, I watched it with my partner again, and it's fantastic.
And he did another stop-motion film last year, Wendell and Wild.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that one yet. You know,
it got fairly good reviews, I think.
Maybe I should add that to my list.
What's it called?
Wendell and Wild.
Okay. Yeah, I'll add that to my watch list.
So, yeah, Coraline is, again, you know, sort of tying into not as in-depth, I don't think, theme. Not as much of a contemplative theme as Del Toro's Pinocchio, where it's got, like, themes of fascism and stuff in it, but it's still sort of dark. And, you know, Coraline as a character is, you know, herself a delinquent. You know, she hates the house that she lives in. You know, they end up moving into these apartments. So she just really dislikes her parents. And honestly, I think the sort of, I don't have children, but the adult part of me is like, just cut your parents some slack.
Yes.
Like, they're trying to feed you healthy food.
I am so with you.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah. You know, really healthy food, and like look after you. It's difficult being an adult, well, in today's economy.
It's not gonna be an adult full stop, let alone with kids in tow as well.
Yeah, with kids, exactly. So, yeah, they move into this apartment. It honestly looks kind of like just a big house. So, what's his name? The other kid, there's a little boy that has, like, a weird neck.
Oh, Wybie.
Wybie. What a name.
Wybie.
Full name, Wyborn.
Oh, Wyborn, yeah.
Wyborn, that's so mean. Wyborn.
Wyborn. I didn't get that. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah, that's what it's meant to be, I'm pretty sure.
Wybie, for whatever reason, creepily gifts Coraline this little doll. And like in the beginning of the film, you see it made, it's almost like a sort of voodoo sort of situation, you know, sewing up. It looks like sawdust that's going in the doll, and obviously a spell or whatever the hell it is cast on it. So, yeah, Wybie's like, oh, this doll looks just like you, you know. He mentions later in the film, that's why she ends up with the doll. But he also mentions, I'm going totally off track. So
we do that often here. It's fine.
That's what group episodes are for, to go off track.
To go off track, yeah, sorry.
No, I mean, hell, just saying, the last time we went off track on a group episode, we discovered that Christian didn't even know who Serena Williams was. Or Roger Federer, or like any
sports person.
Well, I'm not a big sports person. I'm not a big sports person myself.
See, I told you, you're basically Christian reincarnated. You are just like the Australian version of Christian.
You're an Australian Christian.
I mean, if I wrote more notes, maybe I would be much more coherent, you know, like Christian would have been, Christian is. So, yeah. But anyway. Yeah, so Wybie kind of like follows Coraline around. She says that she's a water witch and she's trying to find this well. And he's like got the night vision goggle things on, which I don't think they would be that comfortable with like everything else that he has set up. And yeah, they obviously meet and all that. And it's his grandmother whose sister passed away or went missing or something like that. And of course, Coraline finds out after finding this random secret door and going into it that there's the ghosts of these girls that have gone missing.
And a boy, I think. I think there was a boy.
Yeah, and there's like this other mother on the other side that looks exactly the same as Coraline's mother and father as well. And everything just sort of ends up deteriorating, you know. She kind of goes to sleep and like wakes up and everything's normal. And then she finds a way back in there because the other mother is trying to coerce her to stay and put buttons on her eyes, just like the doll. And everybody in this world, in this sort of other world, has buttons on their eyes. So it ends up being some witch that's trying to steal her away and, of course, had stolen away all these other and imprisoned all these other children. It's almost like it's all in her imagination, which I think is sort of the whole, you know, context of the film.
It was real to me, damn it.
It was real to Jason. So, yeah, and the whole idea of imagination, like possibly... it was all in her imagination. She's like finding all these things. Like, I think it's like the top of a gear stick because you can see like the numbers and the reverse thing is like one of these balls that she finds. That's like the eyes of one of the ghosts and all these other little knickknacks and trinkets. And she's able to find it with like this little candy triangle eye thing that she gets off the two old ladies that live in the downstairs of the apartment. Who are
kind of scary.
Very scary, but, yeah.
But also kind of funny.
Yeah, a bit yeah, mixed feelings about those guys. They seem like they mean well. But yeah, their collection of stuffed dogs on the shelf was very psycho. Yeah.
Sort of like Norman Bates, as I was going to say, like his stuffed birds and psycho.
Yeah.
We've managed to connect Coraline with psycho, which is
It's interesting because I think the apartment house looks almost like
the house looks similar.
Yeah, the house.
There you go. Maybe it was inspired. Yeah. I mean, Hitchcock did inspire a lot of people.
Yeah. So, I mean, to cut things short without rambling too much, the whole idea of the film, I think, is that she ends up appreciating her parents. Because she goes through this whole ordeal and finally throws like the key for this door down the well, and she just her parents. I don't know if her parents were gaslighting her when you know because she has to try and find. Obviously, there's a massive plot point that I've missed is that she has to go and find her parents in this other world as well.
I think they're just meant to forget.
Yeah, I think like, that's it.
They don't seem to know anything that's happened.
No, but there's just something in, you know, in me that's like, oh, maybe they're totally just gaslighting her because she's a child, you know? So it's like, I don't know what you're talking about, you know? Yeah, happily ever after. So they're totally there for the whole thing, you know, during. I thought it was a fantastic, really good film. I say it just about every movie on this list, these three movies, were all fantastic films. I liked the film that Jason liked, that Jason picked more, but yeah, I gave Coraline a good, three stars. I think it was a pretty solid movie. Yeah. What do you think, George?
I gave it 3.5. So I thought it was good. It was good. I liked it more for the animation side of things and like the character designs than I did for the story. The story didn't really grab me as much as I thought it would, maybe because it's more targeted towards kids. Like, I was still engaged with it and I was still enjoying it, but I was more appreciating like the character designs, like the other mother, when she turns into a witch. Some of the settings I thought were obviously great, like every frame was sort of like a painting almost. Like I loved the sort of look of it, like a sort of the dark style of it. I loved. But yeah, the story, I don't know, like it didn't sort of flow as much as I sort of would have liked it to. It felt a bit disjointed to me at times. And I thought the third act sort of dragged a little bit, like the sequence, you know, where the hand comes out, like the hand, like her, the witch's hand comes out and like tries to attack them both. I thought it, I don't know, it felt a little bit tacked on, and I was like, I don't know, I thought the pacing could have been a bit better, but that was sort of like a nitpick, I guess. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, so I could be looking at this from like a different point of view, but I know that the whole message, I guess, is that Coraline learns to appreciate her parents more, right? But and sort of, I thought of this, and there were some people on Letterboxd also saying it, like, Coraline's parents don't seem to like learn, because obviously they're quite neglectful of her throughout the film, right? They don't seem to like learn anything or go through any sort of arc about learning to love her more and like appreciate her more. Like Coraline learns to appreciate her real parents, because she obviously is scared of the other mother, and she learns, and this is real life, etc. But like, the parents sort of magically reappear after being trapped, and they give her a gift, okay? But, like, did they really have a sort of paradigm shift, or, like, will they just revert back to their, like, sort of self-absorbed selves? Like, I don't know. It didn't really feel like anybody learned anything apart from Coraline, but maybe that went over my head. I don't know.
No, I'd agree. I think they didn't learn anything, but I think the point wasn't for them to learn anything.
No, I know. But in my adult mind, I just think it's the parents' responsibility to change and to not neglect your child. The child shouldn't be thinking to accept it more. It should be the parent. But that's just me. I know it's a kid's film. That's just me probably looking at it too self-seriously. So
I agree. The adults didn't learn anything. Yeah. Because they didn't even have the self-awareness to realize they were being neglectful. Right?
Exactly. Like if they realized the danger that Coraline was in and the danger that they were in, maybe they could have had a shift where they thought, okay, we need to sort of give more love to Coraline and pay more attention to her. But that's just, yeah. But that doesn't really impact my enjoyment, because obviously the story is about Coraline and her sort of arc. So that was fine. Overall, I thought it was good. There were parts of the plot where I was like, why? Like, that doesn't really make much sense. But again, it's a kid's film, so you can overlook it. Like, the rules of the world don't really make much sense if you really think about it. In terms of animation and, like, the look of it, I give it a 10 out of 10. Like, because I was reading up on the production, and they built loads of, like, sets and smaller sets, and, like, they built all the houses. There were 28 animators working on it at one time. Every object on screen was made for the film. They like used 3D printers and stuff. So in terms of like production, it's like 10 out of 10. Like I love that side of it. But story let me down a little bit. But that's my two cents on it. Yeah. Jason?
I really liked Coraline. I think I liked it the most out of any of us. Because I gave it 4 stars.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, a positive outlier for once.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the animation, I thought, like you said, George was great. The voice acting was fantastic. It was actually young Dakota Fanning as Coraline. Yeah, like I thought it was charming again. I nearly put it in my top 25 most charming films. I didn't in the end. I did put Pinocchio in there, but I didn't. I nearly put Coraline in, but then I'm like, I don't know. But it was a very charming film. And I do think, like, towards the end, it had good tension. Like, when she was stuck in, like, the other world, and you're like, is she going to get out? Is she not? So I thought it did all that well. I do think it was too long. Like, it was only 100 minutes, but I just felt like it dragged at times.
Yeah, that was my deal a little bit. Like,
but I'm like, well, but then I think I'm like, well, what could you cut out? Like, I can't think of anything that was sort of irrelevant in my mind. So I'm like, even if you put it down to like 90 minutes or below, I'm like, I feel like it dragged, but I can't think of anything to get rid of. So
yeah.
But I mean, look, yeah, very good pick. I liked it. Solid 4-star film.
I will add, can I add something? I really like the cat. Like the cat as a character. That was one of my favorite characters.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I totally left that out.
Like he was really cool. And obviously he sort of played quite an important part in the story as well.
Yes.
So I liked him actually.
Yeah, the cat was good.
Yeah. Oh, and the music by Bruno Coulet. I thought the music was great as well. Just a side note.
Yeah, I didn't really pick up on the music. But...
yeah, it was good. It was good. Like it's yeah.
Apparently they used a real children's choir to do a lot of the music, like the non-singing music, like the sort of ambient sort of choir.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay, that's cool. Music. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Very haunting.
Yeah, yeah. That was good. And I think as a child, the general mood would have scared me. Like if you're a child with like the pit, you know, the sort of button eyes, like it's pretty scary for a child.
Yes.
I better do as I'm told, otherwise I'll have buttons sewn on my eyes, you know.
Well, that's sort of like Pinocchio. It's like you better do as you're told, otherwise you're
going to get kidnapped by a fascist Podesta made to dance.
Apparently Mussolini in Pinocchio was voiced by Tom Kenny.
Who is Tom Kenny? Yeah, sorry.
SpongeBob.
SpongeBob. Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. That's funny. That's a funny
thing. You know, like, every voice actor behind the person, Jacob. You're like the voice actor king. Like
Sometimes I can. Like, I mean, sometimes I do look it up.
I mean, I'm like... I'm saying that off one thing where like last episode of it, you're like, oh, that guy's the voice of Mario. Like, but I'm basing it off one example.
Oh,
like you're the king of voice actor knowledge. Like
So sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. With my partner, you know,
we're gonna quiz you from now something. On.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any voice acting can gonna come straight to you.
Yeah.
I'll try not to look it up.
Yeah.
I'll try and I'll at least tell you if I guessed it and then and then I'll look it up.
Yeah.
So we'll unfortunately move on to my film, which I did not like at all, but I know you two did like.
Oh my god!
So I will begrudgingly talk about my film.
Actually, you know, when this was your pick, wasn't it? For some reason in my mind, before I had it as Jacob's pick. So I was going to make a joke about you not liking another one of Jacob's picks.
It sort of is up. Like if Jacob had picked this, I'd be like, yeah, that's on brand. Like,
it's great.
And the thing is, our other two picks, Pinocchio and Coraline, were sort of like by committee because it was just sort of picking like what's a stop motion film we can all get a hold of. And I guess mine was sort of to a degree as well. So like all our picks, I feel like next group episode, whatever theme we pick, our picks might be more, I guess, representative of us. Because this one, it was just like we were picking very specific films of like what we could all watch. This is definitely not representative of me or my tastes. The film is Anomalisa from 2015. It's actually co-directed. So Charlie Kaufman, however you say it, is one director, and then Duke Johnson is the other director. But it was written by Kaufman as well. So it follows, it's set like 2005. It follows this guy called Michael Stone, who's like this customer service expert, and he's written this book about customer service, and he's traveled to Cincinnati, Ohio to deliver a speech about his book at this seminar. But he suffers from something called the Fregoli delusion, which is where you think everybody has the same face or voice. You basically think everybody is the same person and they're just like different people, but it's all the one person. So as a result of this, everybody he meets, is obviously individual people, but they all look the same, they all sound the same. And as he's staying in his hotel, he hears a different voice for the first time. And so before this, he met up with, so he's married with a son, but he had this like fling with this woman, like 10 years ago, but she corrects him and says it was 11 years ago. And he meets up with her in the hotel but things don't go well, and if you like, storms out. And that's not really relevant to the rest of the plot, but I guess I've heard him there.
Kind of is.
You two might touch on it later. Anyway, so he's in his room and he hears a different voice for the first time. It could be the first time ever, the first time in however many years. We're not really given a time frame of how long he's been suffering from this delusion. So he hears his voice and he like runs out to find it. And it belongs to this woman called Lisa, who is there with her friend Emily to attend the seminar because they're big fans of him and they work in customer service and they've read his book. So him and Lisa like hit it off and they end up like spending the night together. And he's like, you know, he's just like fascinated with her because she's the first person he's met in however long that does not look or sound. I mean, the voice is really the thing. It's not so much of a look, like, you know, that has a different voice to anyone else. But the next day, the next day, because he's so enamored by this person, you know, he hasn't heard a new voice in however long, he's like, oh, I'm going to leave my wife and child and run off with you. But she then starts to morph into everyone else, and her voice starts to go back to like everybody else's voice, and she her like features start to look like everybody else. And so he goes home, and yeah, he just goes home, and like same thing's happening. Like he doesn't recognize anybody. There's like his wife is throwing him this surprise party when he gets home. He doesn't know who anybody there is. And it ends with like Lisa writing him a letter. And the final shot is like it is Emily's in the car with Lisa, and it like the camera goes over to Emily, and she now has her own unique face too, which we can touch on the meaning of that soon enough. So I gave it 1 star. I did not like it at all.
Can I just say again, as soon as I sort of got about 10, 20 minutes in, I can tell now.
You know. I know.
I knew this was going to be a half star or a 1 star.
I'm surprised. So, I'm surprised it's a full star.
Well, yeah, see, no. The reasoning is something like Persona, right? I think Persona is probably a more, you know, obviously a better in some ways, certainly a more important film than Anna Melissa. But I was thinking of it in that sense of, I can tell Kaufman was trying to say something. And I did look up the messages, and I sort of understand the messages more in this than I did in Persona. Persona, I still have no clue what I watch, but I can understand what Kaufman was trying to get across to me. So I gave it 1 star instead of 0.5 star, because I'm like, well, there is some meaning there. It's not completely irredeemable and pointless. Like there is something there. I just don't necessarily like it, but I can tell there was meaning behind it, and there was, you know, so that's why.
So why so low then?
Good question.
I think it's an interesting concept. Like, so there's another film. What was the other film I was going to compare it to?
Team America? Oh.
I've never seen that.
Very apt comparison. Yeah.
No, I was going to compare it to actually one of your picks, Jacob, which I also didn't like. Sorry, Bad Boy Bobby, right?
Oh yeah,
which I did like.
Oh, I would love to talk about that film.
Yeah.
No, we talked about it too late.
Damn.
Which is when George and I discussed it, I said, it's an interesting concept in, like, you know, Bad Boy Bobby, it's this person, you know, sequestered from civilization, and what impact does that have upon someone? Like, that's a really interesting concept. I just didn't feel like Bad Boy Bobby did it well. And so if I look at Anna Melissa, I'm like, even if you take like the literal concept or the metaphorical concept, so if you take the literal concept of the Fregoli delusion, or if you take the metaphorical concept, which is that, you know, he goes through life thinking everybody's the same, and, you know, nobody's unique. He's the only special person. You know, everybody is just the same robot as such, puppets, robots, whatever you want to call them. That's an interesting concept, but I don't feel like it dealt with that concept in a very interesting way. It didn't really have a lot of depth, in my opinion, in the way it's.
I kind of connected to it in that respect. You know, like I've worked in retail for a lot of my working life, and when customers come in, you do get your odd customer that they like to have a chat and they're really friendly.
Yeah.
When you're in that sort of zone, in like a customer service position. Funnily enough, he's a customer service expert.
Yeah.
maybe he's been in that sort of role for way too long. You just see customers, even though he goes up and he does that big speech, you know, his actual talk.
Disastrous speech.
It's very disastrous. He says, you know, everybody's an individual, this and that. And obviously he doesn't see everybody as an individual. Everybody's the same. So being in customer service for a very long time, you have these things you say to them that you know will be very generic things that will most likely make them happy or listen to you, or you know, because it's just customers, it's customer service. You know, I do pride myself in my own customer service.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, your employer will be glad to hear that.
Yes, absolutely. So that's how I think I totally connected to it in that respect. Everybody being the same and having the same sort of voice. Not that I have the Fregoli, I'm delusional or anything.
Are you Michael
you know?
Stern?
But when you work in retail, it definitely plays into that, definitely.
Totally connected to that. Sorry, Jason.
You both loved it, so why don't one of you tell me tell us all what you loved about it, either of you.
Would you like to go first, George, or me? Or
yeah, I guess. I mean, I gave it 4 stars, so I thought it was a great film. And it explored a lot of sort of interesting psychological themes and topics, which I don't think I have a proper handle on. I looked up a lot of sort of analysis and discussion, but there's a lot of themes going on, like depression, narcissism, the Fregoli delusion, the meaning of the doll, the sort of perception of the world. There's a lot of complex things happening. So I do need to do more sort of research into it. But when I was watching it, I was sort of, you know, I thought the pacing was good. I was engaged with it. And I like that it's so rich in discussion, because it's something you can sort of rewatch and dive into again.
I will say, out of the 3 films you discussed, this is by far the deepest. And that's not an insult to Pinocchio or Coraline, because I think they have themes of their own which you can explore, but this is definitely the most thinking film, if you will, most intelligent film.
Because people were kind of talking about whether he's a sympathetic character or not, and it's kind of clear, a lot of people were saying it's clear that he's not, because at the end of the day, like, he's doing this to himself. Like, it's pretty clear he's an A-grade, like, narcissistic asshole. Like, he is unsympathetic. Like, we're not supposed to sort of sympathize with him, really,
I feel like there is a part of you that could as well, because if you're like,
that's what I mean.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, like, no, yeah, like, you sort of recognize that he's doing this to himself, but at the same time, he's in so deep that some people may have, you know, problems with that, in that they can't sort of identify people, they can't connect with people as individual people. Like, they see everyone as just this same boring person, and they struggle to connect with people on a, like, proper, you know, individual basis. So it's kind of like a cautionary tale, in a way, like warning against people getting, like, Michael does, like losing sort of all sense of sort of purpose and seeing everyone as just sort of faceless. So, like, I can see why some people wouldn't sympathize with Michael due to his affair, but, like, if you look at the whole picture, like, it's clearly a man who's sort of struggling his whole life with, like, treating people as proper individuals, if that makes sense. And I found a quote from a Letterboxd reviewer, which is good. It's the film is very interesting, blah blah blah. Michael's character is excellent. He is a customer service expert, but despises all efforts the staff has to give him a good service. He has a wife and kid, but feels lost. We learn he has a troublesome past with a woman and is constantly looking for someone different and anomaly. When he finds Lisa, he tries hard to have her, but the minute he does, she stops being that anomaly. Anna Melissa is the tragedy of Michael, a guy who has everything and yet feels alone and unhappy. the minute he gets something he wants, his own mind transforms it into something boring and disposable. Michael believes everyone else is a mistake, when in reality, it's him who needs to change in order to love and live. But the film leaves his arc incomplete. Maybe that's the point. He'll never change. So, like, I don't know. There are so many sort of interesting themes. And, you know, there's this whole theory, I think Jacob would talk about it as well, with, like, the doll, the sex doll that he
gets. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because people are saying that, some people are saying that he imagined Lisa, and that because at the end, semen is found in the doll.
Yeah, that's
he basically had sex. He had sex with the doll.
Doll, yeah.
I've not even heard this. It's all new to me.
Yeah, so because the wife says, "Oh, there's semen in it," because the boy plays with it, and it, so the theory is that Lisa doesn't exist, and he instead, because also there's a scar on the doll's eye.
The blemish.
I didn't even see this.
Yeah, so there's that theory, but also, people say that Lisa is real because at the end we get a proper point of view scene with her and her friend where there's a real face. So it's kind of both are true. It's how you choose to, like, he could have made it Lisa, he could have just gone to get the doll, because the Lisa and the doll represent the same thing. It's kind of like an object that he just sort of has sex with and then sort of tries to form a connection with it almost, but sort of can't. So both are true. It just depends how you choose to look at it. But that's a very interesting sort of theory to sort of dive into.
It's very sort of dark.
Because
when you start to imagine, like, the whole experience that he had with Lisa, and you're like, you try, I don't know, maybe I'm just a little bit fucked up, but you try to imagine him having that experience with the doll, like, sort of semi-visually, and you're just like...
Yeah, well,
it's crazy, man.
I know, but you know, he also, the doll is voiced by Jennifer Jason Leigh as well. So, like, that also, I guess, that's a bit credence there. And also, Lisa says she likes learning Japanese. The doll's Japanese. She has a Japanese dictionary. Yeah. So, like, there are clues as to it. But yeah. And then I'm not gonna read them all, but I found loads of sort of comments on Reddit about it. I won't go into it all, but you know, there's a ton of interesting stuff.
There's a lot of analysis.
Jacob, sort of, what are your sort of thoughts?
Well, I think the film itself, not to disparage or anything, if that's the right word to use, the other two films as stop motion, they were top of the craft. You know, they obviously use different techniques, still all stop motion, but different sort of ways to make it. But the way they made this film, it sort of stands up as its own, like, artwork, if that makes sense. Like, it was just
it's so deep.
Sort of deep and easy to follow. And just about every scene, of course, the stop motion, they want to make the most of it. But every scene was just so somewhat easy to follow. And then you analyze it deeper and it's just so many levels. But that animation style where where everybody, they all look like sort of crash test dummies or something, because they have the lines on their eyes. It's sort of where they will change.
Well, it's meant to be a mask as well, right? Like, it's
like a mask.
And
he breaks the fourth wall that when he's sort of lower half of his face comes off. Like, he's in the hall. His face goes all crazy and because he's hallucinating, because apparently the Fregoli delusion is hallucinate and everything like that. But that moment where he's running down the hall and he's half of his face is off and you just see his eyes and I thought that was one of the coolest scenes.
Yeah, that whole dream sequence is really well done.
Because
it's sort of, I guess it's meant to symbolize the fact that he thinks that, like, well, everyone in the dream is telling him that, like, he can't have Lisa, which is his, like, sort of ultimate goal at that point, I guess. But it's dream sequence is really good. It's really good.
The hotel manager.
Yeah, the hotel manager says that he, like, loves him and stuff. It's a bit weird, but it's a really good scene.
Crazy. I love that. I love how it was, like, psychological, again, on those very...
Because people, I'm not saying that this is you, Jason, but a lot of like the one star and the one and a half star reviews I was reading.
People, not you, Jason,
but some people. They were saying, oh, like one star, like this guy is terrible, like he's a dick.
Yeah, which was, yeah, that didn't influence me at all.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But the thing is, yes, but like people are complex. Like you're allowed to make films about dicks and complex people. Like just because you don't agree, like he had an affair, which I know you don't, which is cheating is terrible. I know, Jason, you don't.
Yeah, I've got a point to say about that.
Yeah, I know. Thing is, but like the film, it doesn't endorse like cheating or say that cheating is good. Like Michael doesn't get anything out of the affair. If anything, it makes him a bit more delusional, and like makes him even worse and makes him go further down the hole. So like if a film has cheating, like as long as it doesn't sort of fully excuse it and the cheating partners aren't sort of justified in some way, I'm on board, because like people cheat, it happens, it's a part of life, you can't avoid it. Like ideally you would say to your partner, I don't love you anymore, I'm leaving, but like it doesn't happen. Like it, like ideally, it doesn't happen. So, I think it's worth exploring films like that.
Yeah.
You know, because it highlights sort of the character study even more. So some of the reviews saying that, oh, I hate this film because Michael's a twat. Like people are complex, and
yeah,
it's kind of it doesn't treat him with sympathy or totally without. It's sort of it's a mixture, so it all mixes together.
Just before Jason sort of talks about the cheating, he's eager. While it doesn't endorse cheating, and you know, yeah, fair enough, everybody commenting that Michael's a wanker, he's a wanker, but I think that just the way they tackled that theme, you know, of cheating, they did it in such a human way. I know he's like, you know, everybody's talking all the same when you forget about all of that sort of stuff, but just the way he's like, you know, he doesn't just lure her in and then just go for it. He's like, just keep talking, like you're the only thing, you're the only person in my life that I can actually, I feel like I can connect to, and he can't connect to his wife and stuff, but
at the same time, like he doesn't love her. It's sort of like a weird fetish thing, I guess, where all he cares about is her singing and her voice,
because
she sounds like unique, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then
there's definitely two sides to that.
Because that breakfast scene, when she starts talking about the zoo, moving to Los Angeles, when she starts talking about banal, normal stuff, his delusion starts to come in again, because he can't face the fact that she's like everyone else. He's in love with the idea of the fact that she's a unique person.
Exactly.
That's why you hear her voice. Like he always fetishizes how weird she is. Like, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like when she.
I thought she was quite charming.
Yeah. No,
well,
she is.
She was annoying in how insecure she was.
Yeah.
She was so insecure. I was girl, can you get some self confidence? Like, come on.
Yeah. Like he clearly preys on these insecure women.
Yeah.
Because,
you know, they're not like other women that are more sort of, I guess, confident and talk about real stuff. And
The other girl. Other girl was insecure as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, oh, am I too fat? You know.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So there's a lot of stuff there.
I will give it a rare compliment and say that I do think the animation style was good, but I do think for like things like you mentioned, like the lines on the face, like it just, and it was sort of off-putting for me. Like it couldn't, like,
I thought it was very artistic. Expression.
I don't know, it's
like Uncanny Valley.
Yes, I know. And I know it was obviously supposed to be like that. Like it was designed to be like that. This didn't impact the rating at all, but I'm just like, why do you have to have someone cheating in a film? Like, what? Like, because the thing about it is he could have been a single dude and this still would have been like, because the point was she had this unique voice, right? That was nothing to do with the fact that, like to me, you could have taken a wife and a kid out of it and kept the film the same, and it still would have been that film, if that makes sense. Like
I disagree.
I disagree. But, because, well, because he's searching for a connection, I suppose, that's like his wife and daughter. You can't really.
But I guess
why he tries to sleep with his ex first. Yeah. The affair is kind of important to the story, personally.
No, look, I know it just wasn't my sort of film, and like if I'd known, I mean I sort of knew what it was, but if I'd known more what it was, I maybe wouldn't have picked that as a film. But you know, we're limited by stop motion, so we had to pick what we had to pick. But
Well,
I liked the other two. That was good. I loved Pinocchio. Yeah. I loved Coraline. Like,
you're a child of heart, Jason.
I'm a child of heart.
Yeah.
I think that wraps up episode 40, first group episode. Thanks everyone for tuning in. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, we'd love it if you would give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and we'll see you next week.